My name is Peter Caldor, and on behalf of my fellow colleagues of the Smith Lecture Committee, Greg Clark and Bill Herditch, thank you for coming this evening. It's great that you're here with us. We hope that you have an enjoyable and thought-provoking night, and that this might stimulate lots of discussion. I know some of you are going out for dinner afterwards to continue the discussion, perhaps catch up with old friends. That's wonderful, so I hope you have a lovely evening. The Smith Lecture is an annual event that now is in its 15th year, and it draws its name from the late Reverend Bruce Smith, who is fondly remembered by many in the room. For some of us, he was a teacher, perhaps a teacher of Latin or Greek at Sydney Grammar. For others, he taught us theology or philosophy at one of the Bible colleges in Sydney. For others, of course, a dear friend. For some in the room, a father, a grandfather. Bruce was a special man whose love of people, of culture, and of God was so wonderfully intertwined. And it was in conversation with Bruce shortly before he died that the concept of this lecture came about. Knowing that for many people, the Bible is not the first point of reference that they would turn to seek out answers for life's questions, the Smith Lecture seeks to explore what points of contact exist between issues that are in society at the moment and Christian perspectives. So we look forward to hearing your feedback on tonight's endeavour. Can I extend a special welcome to members of Bruce's family who are here tonight? His son David and wife Angela, Rob and Claire and their son Nathaniel, and Andrew and Annette. Let me just quickly explain how tonight will proceed before I introduce Roy and we get underway. Roy will speak for 45 minutes and then he invites lots of questions from you or comments, and we'll reserve about 15, 20 minutes for that. The way we're going to do that is really just the old-fashioned way of raising your hand. We're not in a big group, room here, so just speak in a nice, clear voice. Try to keep your questions or comments succinct. I will repeat them for the sake of the recording, and then Roy will do his best to respond. At the end of that, Greg Clark will do a vote of thanks, and Andrew Smith will present the customary gift to our speaker. Well, let me introduce our speaker then for tonight, Roy Williams. Roy is one of Australia's emerging public intellectuals. His non-fiction book reviews have appeared regularly in the Weekend Australian since 2006. He writes and speaks knowledgeably about a wide range of subjects, including politics, history, science, sociology, sport, law, and religion. That's quite a list. His recent books include Post-God Nation, In God They Trust, and God Actually. Writing is actually Roy's second career. His first was as a lawyer. He won the Sydney University Medal in 1986 and spent 20 years in the legal profession at Australia's oldest and most eminent firm, Allens Arthur Robinson. Roy left the law in late 2004 when stricken by a life-changing illness. Now 52, he lives in Sydney and is married to Sally, and they have five daughters together. I'd now like to call on Roy to deliver the 2015 Smith Lecture, The Secular Juggernaut. Does it matter that Australians are abandoning Christianity? Please welcome Roy.
Thank you very much, Peter, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Let me begin with a personal confession. Not very many years ago, it would have been quite inconceivable to me that one day I'd be extolling the greatness of Christianity, let alone be invited to give a public lecture on the subject. For the first 35 years of my life, when it came to religion, I was a disengaged agnostic, drifting towards atheism. I cannot stress enough why this was so. It was not because I'd had some bad experience within a church. It was certainly not because I had never given careful thought to the question of God's existence and then rejected the notion as improbable. Rather, it was because, not having been raised in a religious home and having attended exclusively state schools, I knew next to nothing about Christianity or any religion. And yet, and this is important, I was always keenly interested in current affairs and generally well educated. As Peter was kind enough to say, at Sydney University Law School in the 1980s, I studied pretty hard and got decent marks. And for nearly 20 years, for my sins, I worked as a solicitor doing mainly commercial litigation. By worldly standards, I was a success. And don't misunderstand me. I'm extremely grateful for that experience. The law taught me how to marshal arguments, to assess evidence, and hopefully to write with precision. So at age 35, I was highly informed about many things of the world, but I was badly ignorant of the most important questions of all. Is there a God who created the universe and created me? If so, what does that God expect of me? I guess I was the epitome of the average Australian citizen, of whom Bishop Tom Frame has written this. The majority of Australians have either no idea what the Christian religion is offering, or they have rejected what they mistakenly think it is offering. Now, it was not always so in Australia. At Federation in 1901, according to the census of that year, 96% of people identified as Christian. Of course, even then there was plenty of nominalism. But one half of all adults went to church every Sunday, and most children went to Sunday school. Furthermore, levels of religious knowledge were reasonably good. I stress the word knowledge. The average Australian citizen had been taught the basics of Christianity as a child, had some familiarity with the Bible, and knew that Christianity had played a seminal part in the formation of the Western world. Until about the 1970s, the educated classes of Australian society were steeped in this knowledge. And I'm talking not only about people of conservative disposition, the wealthy ruling class, but progressives and reformers too. Most of the leaders of the early trade union movement in Australia, for example, were Protestant Christian socialists, the genuine article. And so too were many of the founders of the Australian Labor Party in the 1890s and the early 20th century. I hope that each of you in the audience has got a copy of the texts I've prepared in the program outlining the enormous positive contribution of Christianity to the West in general and to Britain and Australia in particular. Scan them at your leisure. I'm very happy to take questions at the end on anything in them. Now, I admit unashamedly that these are lists of positives. Of course, there are also negative aspects to each of those stories, and I'm indeed going to talk about a number of them tonight. But I make no bones about putting the Christian case forward. It's not put forward often enough in the public square, and I truly believe that the positives far outweigh the negatives. Well, what is the state of Christianity in Australia today? Frankly, most of our political and media class is now ignorant of religion, if not openly antagonistic towards it. As for the general population, according to the 2011 census, nominal Christianity is now at 61% and falling fast. I'll predict here tonight that it'll be much closer to 50% when next year's census is taken, and perhaps even below 50%. And that's nominal Christianity. Perhaps a more telling statistic is this one. Only around 8% of people go to church regularly. Now, as a lady pointed out to me beforehand this evening, that's still more people than attend on a given weekend all codes of football in Australia. But it's still a long way down from 50% in 1901. Now, by contrast, more than 20%, that's one in five Australians, are prepared to state that they have no religion. And many say it proudly. And many admit that no religion is what they want for their children. Now, the $64,000 questions are these. Why is it so? And why does it matter? Tonight, I will suggest reasons why levels of religious belief and church going in Australia have fallen so sharply since Federation, and especially since the 1970s. It is not because most citizens have made a careful study of the Christian religion and, weighing all of the relevant evidence, have decided in good conscience that it is not true. And it is not because most citizens have decided, likewise after careful study, that wherever the truth might lie, the issues involved are unimportant. They're not worth considering. Now, that must be right, because if pressed, any sensible person must admit that the question whether Christianity is true or false is one of vital importance. For if it is true, and I repeat, if it is true, what is at stake is nothing less than the fate of each person's soul for eternity. Now, that said, let me make another thing absolutely clear. I am not going to argue tonight that in this earthly life it is impossible to be a good citizen without practising religion. Obviously not. There are, and there always have been, many badly behaved people who profess to be believers, and many comparatively well-behaved citizens who rarely give religion a second thought. I accept that. Before my own conversion to Christianity, I was not an obviously bad person. Like everyone, I overrated my own virtues, and still do. My parents were highly ethical people who taught me right from wrong. I was a respectable citizen, but something was missing. Something big. I was an unconscious product, victim, I would say, of the secular juggernaut, as I call it. I now realise that I made all kinds of assumptions which are seriously questionable. I did not understand the good news at the heart of Christianity. I did not know nearly enough history, even though I'd studied it at university, both ancient and modern. I did not properly understand the history of my own country. Well, what were the main factors working upon me? I believe they were typical of the factors that are working and still working on most Australians today. In my opinion, there are four really big factors, and I'll come to those in a moment. But before I do that, I'd better clarify what I mean by Christianity. Apologies to purists in the room. I would say that at its absolute core, Christianity is a worldview that encompasses sincere belief in the following three things. First, an all-knowing God who created and sustains the universe, and who is vitally interested in the thoughts and conduct of each individual human being. In short, a personal creator God. Second, an afterlife in which each human being will be called to account by this God for his or her conduct in their earthly life. In short, divine judgment. Third, the divinity of Jesus of Nazareth. Now, on that third point, Jesus' divinity, I think I need to expand just a bit. Almost all serious historians agree that Jesus was, at the very least, a real flesh and blood man who lived in Palestine from approximately 6 BC to 30 AD. Of course, the dates are set by reference to his life. But Christians believe a lot more than that. They believe that Jesus was actually God in human form. Most believe that his divinity was demonstrated by, among many other things, his bodily resurrection from death. And most believe that the primary purpose of his death was to spare those who put their faith in him from the adverse judgment in the afterlife that each and every one of us will otherwise deserve. That's what I believe. Now, it's conceded in the New Testament itself that these beliefs will seem like foolishness to the rest of the world. It's the exact word used, foolishness, 1 Corinthians 1:18. But please suspend any disbelief for a moment. If Jesus really was God in human form, amazing as that concept sounds, then everything he said and did must be understood in that context, and the whole of the Bible must be read in that context. I might say the divinity of Jesus is also integral to the other two core Christian beliefs I just mentioned, because Christians believe that the universe was created by and for and through Jesus. It's Colossians 1:16. And they also believe that Jesus will be the judge of each person in the afterlife. John 5:22. Now, if you really believe those three things and plenty more, life becomes an amazing mixture of hopes and fears. Nagging fear of God's judgment, and indeed judgment by one's fellow believers, but hope in God's ultimate mercy through Jesus. Which brings me back to the secular juggernaut. Now, in trying to explain increasing levels of unbelief in Australia, what I think we're looking for are phenomena that, as a matter of cause and effect, and rightly or wrongly, have undermined those hopes or assuaged those fears that are central to the Christian worldview. Let me just state the three bedrock essentials again. They are belief in a personal creator God, divine judgment, and the divinity of Jesus. Now, with all that in mind, let's take a look at the causes of unbelief in Australia. Now, I'll admit there are many competing theories. Men have written entire books on this subject who are considerably better qualified than me. But I want to start with three possible causes that have been mooted from time to time that do not make my own list. I don't say these factors are irrelevant, but I do regard them as secondary and even minor. The first is multiculturalism. Now, it could be said, has been said to me many times, Roy, you were born in 1963, and so you grew up in the era of multiculturalism in Australia. The various waves of post-World War II immigration have changed Australia irrevocably, and this has harmed Christianity. What do I say to that? Well, it's true that since World War II, mainline Protestant Christianity has been diluted. It's also true that people of non-Christian faiths now comprise a not insignificant portion of the Australian population. But it's still a relatively small proportion, 7%. The biggest three faiths in this order are Buddhism, Islam and Hinduism, roughly 2% each, 2%. So let's keep things in perspective. I would also say this. Australia has always been a multicultural society. The great social commentator Donald Horne made this point passionately. From the very beginning in 1788, our population was a roiling mix of English, Irish, Scottish, Welsh, Jewish, and Indigenous. In those days, the divisions between Protestants and Catholics, between Anglicans and other Protestant nonconformists, between the free settlers and the emancipists, between the Europeans and the indigenous, were every bit as strong as any that exist today, if not worse. But religion still endured, and indeed ultimately it thrived. I'd also stress that post-World War II multiculturalism and immigration that caused it was actively facilitated by the Christian churches here, especially in the initial stages by the Catholic Church. Furthermore, by and large, I think it's fair to say that the churches in Australia have an excellent record on issues of race, including Indigenous issues. Did you know, for example, that it was largely Christian missionaries and other Christian voices who saved the Indigenous population of this country from total extinction? Now, almost all competent historians, secular and Christian, now accept this. And I'll quote the words of just one of them, a historian called Robert Kenny. He recently wrote, in the mid-19th century, and I think he was surprised by the results of his research, in the mid-19th century, a secular belief in a future for Aboriginal Australians, or a right to that future, was difficult to find. Those who believed in such a future were driven not by visions of democratic equality, still by less of Enlightenment philosophy, but by dogged Christian faith. More recently, I would say, the Australian churches have had an honourable record on matters affecting immigrants and the Indigenous and asylum seekers and foreign aid. So in my opinion, there is no dichotomy at all between multiculturalism and Christian belief. As to non-Christian religions, look, it can't be denied that there are very real differences between each of them, and certainly between each of them and Christianity. Even so, I'd suggest that believing Christians have rather more in common with people of other faiths, at least theistic faiths, than with people of no faith at all. So let's move to another hot-button topic and another suggested cause of declining belief, and that's the church's perceived hostility to women. It could be said, and again has been said to me many times, Roy, you are a man. Christianity is a patriarchal religion. Of course modern women are not interested in it. Prominent Australian atheist writer Jane Caro typifies this mindset, I think. She recently quipped in a book, "The idea that women," I'm quoting, "the idea that women are fully human is something man-made religions seem to struggle with." Now, the first thing I'd say in response to that is that women's rights as we know them, it's a matter of history, began with Christianity. Now, that's a multifaceted historical argument, and I'm happy to elaborate later in question time if need be. Today it is true that there are several controversial issues of Christian doctrine peculiarly affecting women: female ordination, contraception, divorce and abortion, for example. And it's also true that over the decades, the stances taken on these issues by many of the churches have been a turn-off for some women. But as a major cause of secularisation, this argument runs into a blunt demographic fact. 60% of practising Christians in Australia today are women, and they're mostly educated women. And at least since the mid-19th century, Australian women have been better churchgoers than men. Indeed, that's true across the West. Now, so if sexism were a core problem, sexism in inverted commas, you'd expect the churches to be full of men, but they're not, and they never have been. The plain fact is that religious women do not think in the way their secular sisters believe they ought. Take three of the absolute giants of early Australian history. Elizabeth MacArthur, who was the key person in the founding of the local wool industry, which kept Australia solvent for decades. Carolyn Chisholm, perhaps our greatest ever charity worker. And Mary MacKillop, of course, our only official saint. All three of them were extremely devout Christians. And so, by the way, were most of the suffragettes who fought successfully for votes for Australian women in the late 19th century, decades before both Britain and the United States. Now, all these women would have been very surprised to be told that their Christian beliefs were somehow incompatible with their status as achieving women. To the contrary, they repeatedly said that their achievements were motivated or at least made possible by their faith. Another point worth stressing about women is this. In respect of all the really controversial issues today, female ordination, abortion and so on, the Australian churches themselves have held a range of positions down the years. Many religious women, and men for that matter, have fought for change from within, and they're still doing so. The point being that none of these things, in my opinion, need be absolute showstoppers. And I don't think they are. Well, let me turn now to a third hot-button issue, and perhaps for some of you it's the elephant in the room, the child sex abuse scandal. Now, one Australian Catholic commentator, Michael Hogan, has suggested, and I quote him recently, that if anything has affected belief and unbelief over the last 20 years, surely it has been a stream of headlines about clergy misconduct. Actually, I disagree. But please don't misunderstand me. Please. Unquestionably, the abuses and cover-ups within all the major churches were morally indefensible. Disgusting, in fact. The churches have provided their critics with powerful ammunition. And unquestionably, too, the ongoing fallout from this scandal makes the church's task harder today. As institutions, they've seriously undermined their own authority, especially on issues of sex, gender, and personal morality. And I think that is a huge shame because, quite apart from theology, the churches have always played a most valuable role in Australia in shaping social policy. I'd argue that on a whole raft of issues, from alcohol consumption to gambling, pornography, working hours, lots of things, the churches have been a tempering, cautionary, conservative voice. And often, not always, but very often, they've been proved right. So, the ongoing child sex abuse scandal is a huge black mark against institutional religion. But the evidence just doesn't establish that it has been a major cause of secularisation. For a start, it wasn't public knowledge until the 1990s. Indeed, the full extent of the problems really weren't known until very recently. And yet the trend towards secularisation had well and truly set in decades before then, in the 1960s, if not much earlier. I'd also add this thought, which is very sobering. Academic studies conducted in Ireland show that a good many victims of abuse, in fact, emerge strengthened in their personal religious faith, albeit understandably hostile to religious institutions. In the words of an Irish writer, Susan Shooter, who's written on this subject, they experience the authentic spirituality of the annihilated soul. So I believe the child sex abuse scandal is not so much a cause of unbelief as a yet another proof, if any were needed, of the reality of human evil. Well, I'm now going to look at what I think and these are just my personal views, what I think are the four most important factors in the secular juggernaut. It's hard to place them in any order of importance, but in combination, they've created a perfect storm. The first factor is sheer ignorance. Most people in Australia today simply don't know much about Christianity or any religion. And sadly, the well-educated professional classes are no exception. Now, who or what is to blame for this state of affairs? In a nutshell, the education system. At least two generations of Australian children now have grown up without any proper teaching about religion. I'm talking about knowledge, not confessional religion, knowledge. And here I include myself, schooled in the 1970s and the early 1980s. Because the fact is that to tackle the big questions, unless you're going to just take everything on faith, and I wouldn't recommend that, if you're going to tackle the big questions, you need at least a basic grounding in theology, in philosophy, ethics, science, and history. Let's be honest. There are many religious issues, even for the most fervent believer, that are genuinely puzzling. Of course there are. Skeptics often ask very tough questions, and I can understand why. Here are three I've often been asked, and I indeed used to ask myself. If God exists, why isn't he obvious to everybody? If human beings are somehow central to God's plan, then why is the universe so vast and so old? Why all that wasted space and wasted time? And the most difficult of all, why would a loving God permit so much suffering and evil in the world? They're just three. Now, all of those questions and many, many others have been tackled by the finest human minds, male and female, for over 3,000 years. I'd humbly suggest it's worth everyone's while to know what answers have been proposed and weigh them up for yourself. Now, today, about two-thirds of Australian children are educated in state schools. The plain truth, all politics aside, the plain truth is that at both the primary and secondary levels, these schools are largely religion-free. This is despite the best efforts of volunteers in all states and territories, what I used to call scripture classes. In Victoria, such volunteers have now been banned altogether from teaching inside school hours. The remaining one-third of Australian children are educated in private schools, and of course most of these schools, not all, but most, are run by the churches. But I'm afraid that going to a church school is no longer, if it ever was, any guarantee of a decent religious education. There are honourable exceptions, of course. But religious tokenism is common, especially at the wealthy end of the Protestant system. Sadly, the churches must bear a lot of the blame for this story, and not only for tokenism in their schools today, or too many of their schools, but for the condition of government schools. And here I have to delve into a bit of history, because all roads lead back to the education debates of the latter 19th century. Until the mid-19th century in Australia, the churches had sole care and conduct of education in the Australian colonies. That's actually an amazing fact of history. The church has educated all our children, including that first generation of native born that in everyone's eyes turned out amazingly well. It's a miracle in many ways. So in tough circumstances, the churches did a valiant job. But ultimately, as a result of a steadily rising population, the gold rushes of the 1850s, there came a time where the churches could no longer cope. They just didn't have the resources. Government schools became a practical necessity in order that all children would get an education, and rightly so. Now, so almost everyone agreed that state education needed to become free and compulsory. But in fact, very few people at that time wanted state schools to become secular in the sense of religion free. That is a modern myth. The real problem was that the churches could not agree amongst themselves on what form of Christianity should be taught in state schools. Protestant Catholic sectarianism was rife, too often vicious. Reasonable attempts at compromise were rejected. And in the end, as they always do, or usually do, politicians took the easiest option. Religion was removed from the state school curriculum in all but fairly superficial ways. Now, of course, the effects of this were masked in the medium term by other factors, including a very strong Sunday school system until the 1970s. But in recent decades, a situation has arisen, and I don't think this is putting it too highly, where the vast majority of Australian children do not receive any decent teaching about religion, either at home or at school. So by the time they are adults, the die is cast for most of them. So it's no wonder that rates of unbelief are skyrocketing. As the Apostle Paul said way back in the year 57 AD or thereabouts in his greatest letter to the Romans, how can they believe in the one of whom they have not heard? How can they hear without someone preaching to them? Well, what's the answer? One, I think, is this. The churches, I believe, have to give religion a much higher priority in their own schools. Remember, they teach a disproportionate number of our future leaders. As for state schools, somehow, and it'll take a miracle, Christians as a collective group must convince the powers that be that religion should become a compulsory, examinable part of the school curriculum, taught by professional teachers in primary and secondary schools. I'd include instruction on all major religions, not just Christianity. Now, it'd have to be non-confessional religion, of course, but even that would be a huge advance on the present. As I see it, that's the only way to give all Australian children a fair chance to make up their own minds about religion in an informed way. It's a simple matter of a fair go. As for adults, well, I suspect that most people need to do some honest soul searching. You have to ask yourself, am I rejecting a straw man version of Christianity? That was certainly so in my own case. And if I may say so, it could be in some of yours. Now, if so, the only course of action is to educate yourself in the basics and then see if you get interested. Perhaps, first up, you don't want to go to church. For me, it was a revelation just to read on the train the four biographies of Jesus, the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. But possibly for you, even the Bible itself looks too forbidding. Fine. Or for a crash course in theology, there are many fine works that are accessible and entertaining, but not dumbed down. I mean, C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, for example, was one book that got me thinking. And so were various books, I might add, about the historiosity of the events described in the New Testament, and especially Jesus' resurrection. I might say one of those books was an old classic called Who Moved the Stone by a man called Frank Morrison, although that wasn't his real name. Morrison actually set out to write a book disproving the resurrection as an actual historical event, and he ended up a Christian. Now, I'll just say this. As a former agnostic leading towards atheism, Christianity won me over initially, because it makes sense of the world. In particular, it makes sense of history, the history of the West, the history of Britain, and the history of Australia. Now, ignorance is a big factor, but it's far from the only one. Plenty of people down the ages have been adequately educated in Christianity, but they've still rejected it. Why? I want to say the core reason is that they've chosen different objects of worship, things of this world. They may not have made this choice consciously, but they've made it nonetheless. I'm going to start with a discussion of nationalism and its most poisonous corollary, war. This is the second of my own big four factors in explaining the secular juggernaut in the 20th century. I mentioned earlier the fact that 60% of churchgoers in Australia are women. Now, the first significant drop in measured levels of religious affiliation and commitment in Australia occurred in the 1920s. And overwhelmingly, it was men rather than women who lapsed. Why? Well, the decline can be traced to a specific historical event. Of course, World War I. That war was a catastrophe on almost every level. It was plainly avoidable, and its short-term and long-term consequences were terrible. Pope Benedict XV in 1914 rightly called it the suicide of civilised Europe. But in fact, Benedict was a rarity. Most church leaders in all countries, on both sides, including Australia, strongly supported their side's cause throughout and led prayers for the destruction of the other side. And what was even worse, the Australian churches, Protestant and Catholic, largely repeated these mistakes during World War II and then again during the Vietnam War. Now, you may ask, how did this harm the cause of religion, especially among men? Well, the answers are complex and, I have to admit, disputed, but I'm going to proffer a few ideas. Most obviously, it was 20th century Australian men, much more so than women, who witnessed the horrors of war firsthand as combatants overseas. And a good proportion of them returned home, those who survived, shell-shocked, maimed, disillusioned with everything. And yet the story obviously is not as simple as that. Let's also remember this. It is almost always men who start wars and fight wars. Men are more inclined than women to see national honour or national security as a primary goal of public policy. Men are more inclined than women to see violence as an effective solution to conflict between nation states. And men are much more inclined than women to sanction the use of lethal force against defenceless civilian populations. And that was the most ghastly legacy of World War II. Now, by buying into this mindset, as the churches did through most of the 20th century, I'd argue they gradually lost their moral authority. Not with everybody, but they lost it most especially among the segment of the population who identify as anti-war, the idealists, the left, if you want to call them that. The Vietnam War was a turning point. And that's when the second big drop in religious affiliation in Australia occurred, in the aftermath of that war. It wasn't the only cause. Of course, there were other causes involved. But I'd argue that was a turning point. Because many people, especially young people, saw religious hypocrisy and they thought it repugnant. Now, one of my own heroes, the great Australian Methodist Alan Walker, who opposed the Vietnam War, which made him very unpopular, once said this: "I respect those who say that the teachings of Jesus won't work in today's world, but I cannot accept the attempts to twist the teachings of Jesus to support war." Now, Jesus was quite unambiguous. He exhorted us to love our enemies, not to repay evil with evil, and to put away the sword. And so did some of the Old Testament prophets. And for the first 300 years after Jesus' death, his followers obeyed these injunctions strictly. Christians spread their faith throughout the Roman Empire without the use of force of any kind, though plenty of lethal force, of course, was used against them. I think that's one of the most amazing facts of human history, and indeed a kind of proof of the truth of Christianity itself. Of course, things changed in the 4th century. It wasn't long before pacifism or even conscientious application of Christian just war theory came to be seen as dangerous, eccentric, stupid. Now, you might ask, why was all this a core problem for religion, for Christianity? The perception of hypocrisy was one factor, but I think there was another one, even more basic. Back in 1914, right here in Australia, there were a handful of visionary churchmen who identified it. They issued a petition. It was on the day of one of the conscription referendums, cautioning against a jingoistic rush to war and a continuation of the war. They warned against a world, these are their words, and I quote, in which patriotism is the virtue which takes the place of Christian brotherhood. The state replaces God, and the national flag replaces the cross. The supreme law is no longer the law of God, but the military safety of the country. Now, back in 1914, the jingoists had a slogan, "The Empire, right or wrong." And I'd argue that the position is similar in Australia today. Nationalism rules. Now, of course, there's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong with concerned and constructive love of country. Just like a parent's concerned, constructive love for a child. But far too often it's just cheerleading. Australia right or wrong. Protection of the Australian nation and our material prosperity and our self-regard seems to have become the supreme goal of public policy. So we've reached a situation more generally where a citizen's ultimate loyalty is not to his or her own conscience, let alone the church, but to the nation or to some other team, political party or a business or a trade union. And I believe people of faith must push back against this mindset. Well, I now want to look at the third of my big four factors in the secular juggernaut, and I call it scientism. Scientism must, of course, be distinguished from the scientific method. It cannot be emphasised enough that the scientific method, empirical reasoning tested by experiment, is in fact a long-term byproduct of Christianity. In my notes, it sits at the very top of my list of Christianity's gifts to the Western world. And it's also worth remembering that until very recently, most of the world's greatest scientists were serious practicing Christians, the men who invented science as we know it, between about the 16th and 18th centuries. And so also, by the way, were many of Australia's greatest scientists since 1788. The problem nowadays is that the amazing success of the scientific method has given rise to the idea that science is the only reliable source of knowledge. So, in Australia today, I'd argue that this notion of scientism wraps up a number of muddled notions, and they're often fostered in the media. First, the notion that the universe is without purpose. It consists of physical matter, transient collections of atoms guided by mindless impersonal forces, and nothing else. A second notion is that belief in the supernatural has been rendered untenable, indeed ridiculous. So the afterlife, the soul, miracles, even human free will, they're all fantasies or illusions. A third notion is that human beings are nothing special. We're just another species. In the words of Stephen Hawking, the atheist scientist, we are just chemical scum on a moderate-sized planet. And fourth, there's this overarching notion that modern science has somehow disproved the Bible in key respects, and indeed has generally superseded all theistic religion. There's no longer any need to invoke God to explain anything. Now, I have to admit that for years I was an adherent, unconsciously, of this mindset. But it was because I didn't know nearly enough about science. And it was reading much more about science, in fact, that got me seriously interested in religion. And I soon learned that all four of those notions I've just listed, and many others, are open at least to very serious question. So take free will, for example. Now, honest atheists will admit that the logical endpoint of their belief system is that there's no such thing. Each of us may imagine that we decide what we do and don't do, but it's really an illusion. There's no you doing the deciding. Now, that's a very strange, counterintuitive idea. Among many other things, it undermines the whole notion of morality, of right or wrong. And it renders illogical our whole system of justice, which is based on the assumption that individuals can be legitimately held accountable for their conduct. As a matter of fact, science doesn't prove that free will is an illusion, in my opinion. But science does prove many incredible things, awe-inspiring things. Personally, I think some of the best arguments for the existence of God are based on the findings of modern science. Cosmology, physics, chemistry, and biology. Yes, biology, including the theory of evolution. Now, I can well understand that some of you may be sceptical, but believe me, I've barely scratched the surface here. And it's an utterly fascinating field of inquiry. Well, you'll be glad to hear I've now come to the fourth and last of my big four factors. Prosperity. Let me repeat that. Prosperity. Material affluence. In my judgment, this may be the biggest factor of all. Australia in 2015 is one of the richest societies in the history of humankind. There has been a threefold increase in real personal income since 1950. In real terms, I stress. So that today's working class, in real terms, is far wealthier than the middle class used to be in earlier decades. And it's been the same more or less throughout the West. And most sociologists agree there's no coincidence that it's in the West where Christianity is in decline. On the other hand, Christianity is in fact gaining ground in many of the less wealthy parts of the world, Asia, Africa, South America. And religion in general is strongest in the third world. Yes. But what are the links between prosperity and unbelief? I think there are various factors at play. It's a tricky area, but I think one factor is simply this, that material comfort tends to act as a kind of spiritual soporific. So in other words, the more pleasant this life, the less focus on the life to come. A second factor is much increased life expectancy, which is a product of prosperity in modern medicine. Now, it's a blessing, of course, but as a matter of cause and effect, it means that for most people in the West, there's a much reduced consciousness of death until old age. Comparatively few people in the West die young nowadays, and that is a different situation to that which pertained throughout all of human history. It's a big change even from the early 20th century, let alone earlier eras. I think a third factor is sheer distraction of technology. We live in a hectic world where there's far less time for quiet, uninterrupted contemplation. But at core, I'd argue, it's actually a question of personal priorities. I mean, I know, and I confess, when I was a partner at a big commercial law firm, earning a lot of money, my own priorities became skewed. And my health suffered badly too. Now, it's almost become a cliche, but it was Paul, after all, who warned that the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. 1 Timothy 6:10. And in the 18th century, John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, of course, he observed this, that true religion must necessarily produce both industry and frugality, and these cannot but produce riches. And that certainly happened in Australia. Many of our finest businessmen and philanthropists have been staunch Christians, steeped in the Protestant work ethic. But the risk, Wesley pointed out, the great risk, is that religion thereby sows the seeds of its own destruction. Wesley said, as riches persist, so will pride, anger, and love of the world. And I'd throw in selfishness, envy, and lack of thankfulness, which I think sadly are all too prevalent mindsets in Australia today, at all income levels, I might add. Well, what's the answer to this? I have to confess, although I'd love to be proved wrong, that I have diminishing faith as I get older in any of the major political parties. And of course, we'd all be disinclined, I think, to wish on Australia and the West an economic catastrophe, though personally I think one may well come, dwarfing the GFC. The answers, I think, are purely spiritual. I'm more and more convinced that it is personally felt Christian faith which is the best insulator against inequality and greed, and certainly the best encourager of charity and compassion. Now, why? Because Christianity, at its purest and best, addresses the core moral issues. Indeed, and I'm winding up now, it does seem to me that some of the core truths of Christianity, some of the core teachings as stated in the Bible, are the best defence against all the main factors, all four of them, in the secular juggernaut. Prosperity? Well, it was Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount who rightly insisted that a man cannot serve two masters, God and money. He also commanded just a few verses earlier, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven. In other words, you can't take it with you. The state of your eternal soul is what counts the most. War? Well, again, it was Jesus who rejected physical violence as an answer to anything. And for 300 years, Christians did reject physical violence as an answer to anything, even in the face of persecution and torture. What about nationalism? Call it patriotism if you want. Well, Jesus warned very strongly against nationalistic self-righteousness and stereotyping. The parable of the Good Samaritan, in fact, addressed those vices directly. One of the lesser-known points about that parable is that the Samaritan was a foreigner from a distrusted nearby land. And it was, of course, the Apostle Paul who maybe who made what may be the most cosmopolitan of all pronouncements. There is neither Jew nor Gentile, neither slave nor free, nor is there male and female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. It's Galatians 3:28. So I'd say Christianity, if it is to mean anything, must transcend national borders. What about scientism? Well, I think science is fantastic, and I think scientism is just a subset of ignorance. So ultimately any solution goes back to the education system. Children have to be taught not less but more about science. Of course, the established facts and theories, but in addition, the history of science, the limits of science, the dangers of science, and the implications of what science really does actually prove. What about ignorance in general? Well, the only cure for ignorance is knowledge. And the Bible rightly says that fools despise wisdom and instruction. Proverbs 1:7. But in the same verse, it hits the nail on the head. It's the fear of the Lord that is the beginning of knowledge. The beginning. I'm sure that's right. But I'm also sure that in the end, hope should trump fear. Indeed, in concluding, I'd just like to quote a few lines from a poem by the Reverend Bruce Smith, the man after whom this lecture is named. So among other things, he was a very distinguished poet, and this is the final stanza of his poem, Being Elsewhere. He wrote, "It's heaven itself, the absence of fear, the reign of love and the prospect of bliss that moves our hearts in a world like this." So Bruce Smith knew that hope is produced by genuine belief in the good news about Jesus. But before anyone can have genuine belief in the gospel, the good news, you must understand it properly. And so Jesus' very last instruction to the apostles was to go and make disciples of all nations. In other words, to teach people. Let us all go out tonight in that spirit, as teachers with loving conviction, as seekers with a truly open mind. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Roy, and you've been a very patient audience. I might just give you a moment just to sort of stretch a little bit, gather yourself. There's an opportunity now for us to be asking questions of Roy, and I'll just repeat what I said earlier. It'd be really good just to keep your comments quite succinct, or your questions, and I'll repeat them for Roy. So do I have anyone who would like to start us off? So the question is it not so much a problem of intellectual assent? It's more a moral question that is perhaps a reason for the secular juggernaut.
Yes, thank you, sir, and I do apologise for going over my 45 minutes. Yes, I'd describe it as more a symptom than a cause, but I argue in my latest book that the introduction of the contraceptive pill in 1961 in Australia was one of those other turning points. It really did revolutionise sexual relationships. And I also argue that the churches, of course, had a mixture of positions on the subject. The Catholic Church is much more hard line and still, as I understand it, prohibits contraception, even in marriage. The Anglican Church pragmatically, I think, decided in the 1930s that for married people, they could make up their own minds in good conscience. In short, sir, I'd agree with you. It was a significant element. And the churches were far from entirely wrong.
So we spoke in the lecture about pacifism, but in reference to the Second World War with the Holocaust, what was the Christian stance to that?
there's an historical answer and there's a theological answer. The historical answer is that World War II was not fought to save the Jews. That's simply a myth. The Holocaust was a consequence of World War II. The Nazis could not have got away with it in peacetime, and they actually instituted the Final Solution when the Americans entered the war shortly after Pearl Harbor, and they knew they were going to lose. By and large, the churches in... of course, given that World War II had started, it was imperative that the Allies prevail. That said, there were very strong pacifist voices in the 1930s, and the real problem was that the war started in the first place. Like World War One, I'd argue it was plainly avoidable because people didn't take to heart sufficiently, especially in the churches and the leadership of all nations, Jesus' teachings, which are unambiguous, in my opinion.
So, how has your understanding of Christianity helped in your understanding of the West and Australia?
Things that we absolutely take for granted in the West. That's just science is one thing I mentioned, product of Christianity. That's a complicated historical argument, but I'm convinced by it. But let's just take another one. The idea of egalitarianism, one absolutely central to Australia, that everyone's equal. That wasn't a precept of the classical world, the Greco-Roman world. It wasn't a precept in most parts of the world other than the West. In fact, it took a long time to properly be worked through in the West. But it all goes back to Genesis 1, that everyone is made in the image of God and therefore all are equal in the sight of God. That's the core principle behind equality before the law, democracy. And I was fascinated the more I traced through history how all these things fell into place. I've written two books about it. I mean, for example, I was amazed when I did the research on the Australian prime ministers at just how many of them, in fact virtually all of them, for a start, had taken religion seriously, even if they weren't practising Christians. But, in fact, a majority were, and what's more, a good number of them were motivated by their faith in ways that really mattered. I was fascinated by that. It made sense of things, I'd always taken for granted without really understanding why have we got all these institutions. Mm.
Thank you. So the question is another contribution to the decline in belief the church's stance on gender and sexuality and freedom of sexual expression?
I think it's an issue. Surveys show that the gay population is about 2% of Australia, although, of course, many more than that sympathise with their cause, especially young people. What can I say? Whatever I say is going to offend someone in the room, so I might as well offend everybody. My personal view, and I've really struggled with this, I admit I've agonised over this, changed my mind a few times. My hybrid position is that if a plebiscite were held tomorrow, I would vote no to same-sex marriage. Simple reason being, I can't reconcile it with scripture in my own conscience. I also think there's just a secular reason that the word has a certain meaning that's just too well entrenched. It shouldn't be changed. My own view on homosexuality, I know many of my evangelical Christian brothers and sisters don't agree with. I personally can't accept the teaching that every single homosexual relationship is inherently sinful. I know that's a minority view among Christians, though a significant minority. I personally have no problem with same-sex civil unions. I do argue in my book that I think ultimately it's got to be a question of conscience, and I can't tell the churches what to do. Obviously, the majority still look at Scripture and say homosexuality is outlawed, and I'm sorry, but you know, celibacy is your only lifelong solution. I think if the churches renounced that teaching and made a big thing of it, it would help. That's my personal view.
So the question is, does the Christian teaching offer advice on how we should live, particularly in relation to issues to do with refugees, both here and in Europe?
Yeah, I mentioned in my talk that I thought the churches, at least in recent times, had an honourable record in relation to this subject. It's very interesting. Of course, all the opinion polls show that a very large majority of Australian citizens approve of our government's policies on refugees. In fact, the majority would make them tougher still. That's the political hard fact that the major parties have to deal with. Only probably fewer than 20% of the population would be in favour of a generous, if you want to call it, open borders policy or simple compassion. What's really interesting to my mind is where that 20% comes from. It's made up of two groups who on many other things violently disagree with each other, but on this issue are at one. On the one hand, you've got evangelical Christian and serious Catholic voices in favour of a far more compassionate approach. The churches have been very good on this issue. And then you have what are sort of derogatorily called the far left, the Greens, most of whom are proud atheists. Not all, but many. They've formed this really strange coalition. What you have in the middle is the vast mass of apathetic Australians who, I think, fall victim to what I call nationalism. So not in our backyard, Australia. We've got to protect what we have, someone else's problem.
So, question, it's Christianity has made a contribution in the past. What are your thoughts about the future?
Okay. There's a few elements to that, sir. One is where do I think levels of belief are going? Well, they're going through the floor. Absent a revival, which, of course, God could at any time initiate. But if secular trends were to continue, we'll be below 50% very soon, even of nominal Christianity. How low could that number fall? Well, I don't know. Could go very low, I suspect, if nothing were to change. But, of course, history is all about change. If you're asking me what sort of why does it matter if levels of belief in Australia continue to fall, well, that is a great question. In fact, I came prepared to answer it. So, at a theological level, of course, it matters hugely because questions of ultimate truth are involved. Nothing could matter more, as I said, than the fate of individual souls for eternity. And everyone needs the chance to make up their own minds in an informed way about those issues, education and so forth. That's the theological answer. In terms of the Australian nation, what do I think? Well, the core question is this, and it doesn't just apply to Australia, it applies to the West in general, and it's fascinating. We're all living off Christian capital, so all of our institutions are the long-term product of centuries of Christendom, with a few classical Greek and Roman elements thrown in and a few Enlightenment ideas thrown in. But by and large, the West was built on the Christian churches. Okay. And all our institutions, all our secular institutions are built on that. And we take it for granted, our ways of thinking. How long will it take? How low does that number have to fall? You know, 30%, 20%, 10%, where only a dwindling proportion of the population actually believe, have the core beliefs that underlay the creation of all those things. That's the question. Now, there are different views on that. Of course, the Soviet Union Nazi Germany, Communist China are examples of societies where a conscious decision was made to get rid of religion. And to say the least, they didn't work out well. That's not going to happen in the West, barring some calamity, war or super GFC or something like that. But I think the real risk is that more and more the atheist vision will be realised, so that might will become right. If there's no fallback, if there's ultimately no judgment, then might becomes right. It's what you can get away with in this world. I don't have a very optimistic view of human nature. Christianity, another thing that's made sense to me is the evil of the world. And the 20th century proved that conclusively. And I do fear that diminishing faith could lead to really awful consequences in the medium term.
Okay, so a reference to the Productivity Commission and reducing penalty rates. And is there scope for keeping a day of rest?
So it's a great question. I actually had a look at the history of Sabbatarianism, as it was called, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, a big movement. Churches fought really hard in Australia to keep Sundays clear, and they were clear of sporting events, shops being open, all sorts of things, for many decades. They lost that argument. That is a great example of the secular juggernaut, just piling over the top of those traditions. And it's a simple, there's a one-word answer, money. Money rules. I would love those days of rest to be truly honoured again, but it's not going to happen.
So the question is, can you comment on another juggernaut, the rise of Islam?
Yeah, well, it's not really the rise of Islam. Islam's
in the West.
Well, as I said, it's still only 2% of the Australian population. What can I say? I've read the books of the people who argue that reform is needed of the Muslim faith of the kind that occurred in the Christian faith back in the 16th century and 15th century. And I find some of those arguments persuasive. And there's no doubt that 9/11 was another catalyst, some sort of turning point, because people with no strong religious affiliations of any kind, there was a plague on all your houses sort of attitude to strongly felt religion. And certainly those spate of new atheist books, the Hitchens and the Dawkins, I don't think it was any coincidence that they came out very shortly after 9/11. But I'll repeat what I said in my lecture, because I sincerely believe it. At core, Christians have a lot more in common with people of genuine Islamic faith than with atheists or uninformed agnostics. Believe in the same God. Islam, of course, teaches Jesus was a prophet, not God. But they believe in the other two limbs, more or less.
I'm honoured to be able to thank Roy for delivering this year's Smith Lecture. Before I do, since no one else will, can we thank Peter Cowder and the City Bible Forum team for organising it? Thank you, Peter. We've seen a lawyer's forensic skill here, but we've also seen a humanitarian's heart in the way that Roy's approached his topic. He's on our side. He may sound like Paul Keating, but he understands politics and history more like Paul Kelly, and he's got a mind and heart that's been informed by St. Paul. So we benefited from all dimensions of that. Thank you very much, Roy. And you located your personal story in a much bigger story, which is very rare in today's individualistic age. So thank you for that. Look, you've told us several shocking things, which we're going to have to reflect on in great detail. Belief that Jesus is God as an intellectual option, you're walking proof of that. That the rights of women were first championed by Christians. That the Australian education system is one of the causes of the rush to unbelief. These are all shocking. that we're all worshippers. Whatever we put on the census form, we're worshipping nation or war or mammon or something else. That more science can actually lead you into religion. That increasing affluence puts you in moral and spiritual sleep, incapable of seeing reality. And that personally felt, well-informed Christian faith is a likely solution to several personal, social and spiritual dilemmas. These are all quite shocking. He's been frank, he's been open, he's been personal. But unlike Keating, he hasn't insulted us at any point. So for that, Roy, we're deeply thankful. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. And I'll just call up Andrew Smith to present the Smith Lecture Vintage.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.